Welcome to the Ulysses European Odyssey podcast. I'm Liam Brown from Arts Over Borders, an Irish organisation which is the lead artistic partner of Ulysses European Odyssey. Ulysses European Odyssey was inspired by the fact that 2022 was the centenary of the publication of James Joyce's great novel Ulysses. And it was also inspired by a desire to celebrate Joyce as a European artist. He lived, after all, most of his adult life in Trieste, Paris, and Zurich. There are 18 episodes in the novel, and so the project shaped itself around the idea of a different European city engaging with each of the episodes. And the project would embrace a whole range of art forms and disciplines. And from each of the episodes in Ulysses, we've identified a contemporary European theme with which the city partners also engage. We're focusing today on episode 5, Lotus Eaters. In that particular episode in Ulysses, Leopold Bloom walks around the centre of Dublin. And the focus in the episode is around desire, attraction, for example, tobacco, alcohol, food, religion, they're all referenced. So we wanted to take that theme to explore the immigrant experience. What is it that attracts an immigrant to a particular city or country? What are they seeking? What are they hoping for? What might, as they see it, change for the better their life and the potential that they may have? So in terms of that theme, Marseille is the perfect city to explore it, migration, porosity, and integration. Immigrants have had a profound influence on Marseille in its development and culture over the centuries. Our creative partners in Marseille are the visual artists Gethin Dick and Miles Quinn, known collectively as the artistic duo Gethin and Miles. Welcome to you both.
Hi there.
I wanted to begin by asking you about your own relationship with Marseille. How did you come to settle in the city, and how has it influenced your life and your work?
So it's kind of a long story, like all the best Marseille stories. And a bit of a shaggy dog. Years and years ago, I lived in Saint-Étienne in France, and that's a city with quite a bad reputation. And I was lucky enough to travel around a bit in France, and all my friends from there always told me you should never go to Marseille. And it was one of these kind of, you know, you always kick downwards. And yeah, so possibly the second worst reputed city in France, slagging off the worst. And Marseille has a terrible reputation in France. And at the time I was young and foolish enough to listen to that. And then years later, I went and was kind of blown away by, it is a very misunderstood place. The French have quite a negative opinion of it. So with all that in mind, I said to Gethin, how about we leave London, where we've worked for quite a long time, and move to this dreadful city? And she said yes.
Yeah, I said, yeah, let's do it. No, that sounds like a great idea. And then about a week later, Miles said, do you think maybe we should visit Marseille before we just pack up and decide to move there, so you can see what it's like? And so I was like, yeah, okay, no, that does sound like a sensible thing to do. And so we visited Marseille, and it was January. At that point, we were living in London, and I had been for about 10 years. And you know, when you reach January in London, it's kind of like you feel like the sky has been about 30 centimetres above your head and dark grey for about a month and a half at that point. And we arrived in Marseille mid-January for a long weekend, and it was 18 degrees and sunny. And just the amount of light hitting the backs of your eyes was mind-blowing. And we were like, yeah, okay, yeah, sold, we'll do it.
And it's never happened again. It's typical Marseille. It was just like, it was a freak January where it was particularly warm. But anyway, so we didn't move here just for the weather. It's, you know, as Liam has said, it's a port city. A lot of our work is kind of maybe collecting stories and working with marginalized groups, or you know, kind of trying to listen and put out voices.
And looking at kind of multitudinous identities within people and within communities, that this idea of homogeneity is unuseful and uninteresting.
And Marseille is really perfect for that, with this kind of, you know, constant historically movement through the port, and then people kind of either managing to move on or kind of getting stuck here, as we did, because initially we left London and it was like, oh, you know, maybe it will be 6-12 months. We didn't know anyone or have any contacts here, and so everyone in London thought we were kind of mad.
Yeah.
And that was 12 years ago. Yeah. So there's something about the city that just kind of holds on to you. It's a really special, it's challenging but beautiful place.
It's sticky. And it's never simple, Marseille, but it's definitely worth it.
I was just thinking about Joyce's sort of belief in the city, that the city was a civilizing influence, that walking its streets could transform you, in a sense, into a better person. And Marseille feels to me it's a city of surprises. You never know what you're going to encounter, and I mean that in an entirely positive way. In terms of your artistic practice, I know it's very difficult to compare, but if you'd stayed on, for example, in London and your experience now in Marseille, do you feel that you're very different artists because you're living in Marseille?
I think being in Marseille gave us space to expand in all kinds of ways that staying in London wouldn't have given us. And I mean that both metaphorically and physically. It gave us resources that we just wouldn't have had in London. Whether those resources were the light, which has become incredibly key to our practice because we use a lot of cyanotype process now, that's entirely dependent on having easy access to reliable sunlight. That's an art practice that would have been almost impossible to develop with such ease in London. There's also the fact that having your difference as an artist made sense of by clear foreignness is in some ways useful to our practice when we're going into places and starting to talk to people and starting to ask them their stories. It gives you a foreignness which sort of helps the interaction in some way.
Yeah, we're obviously outsiders. We're not speaking our mother tongue.
Yeah.
But I think, like, London and Marseille have lots in common as well. You know, I mean, and we sort of joked at the beginning, we did lots of projects in and around Brixton because we had this kind of thing of the artist should be visible outside the studio and implicated in the local community and, you know, and so working local as an idea. And then we'd done a lot of projects in South London and felt we needed a new local. And we kind of made it here. But we sort of joked that Marseille was like Brixton sur Mer. You know, there is a real, just kind of a messy cultural overlaying and these kind of multiple identities that are conflicting and chiming together and all those brilliant, messy things that happen in cities that, you know, we were, you know, really interested in doing. I'm just gonna, you can't keep on, when if you keep on pointing at me like that, I'm gonna get scared.
Okay, I won't.
It's just, what do you want to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say something on that. It was just before we wrapped up on cities, but yeah, I keep forgetting they can just cut chunks out. Just on Joyce believing in the civilizing influence of cities, I'm not sure he would have said that about Marseille. And I think that that actually has really brought us something as well. I think there's something in the sort of chaotic, ill-disciplined possibilities of Marseille that there still exist these sort of interstices where something interesting can happen. It hasn't all been tidied up yet.
And it also makes it this kind of place where everything feels possible until you try to do it. And it kind of is and isn't the the easy things, what should be easy or would be easy in London or Paris, can be incredibly hard. And then the ridiculously overblown things, oh yeah, no, you can do that. You know, oh, oh no, have that warehouse for a month or whatever. So there's kind of, you don't know what you're going to get. And so, yeah, I don't know about civilizing, but it's kind of a constant education. You can't be complacent. And I think the point of surprises is really true. There's always there's a surprise around every corner every day. You know, there's something if you're looking. So it's a really alive place, which is, if you're interested in working with place and people, I don't think you could pick much better than Marseille.
You talk about how participation, collaboration, they're at the heart of the work that you do. And that's also true of the project called We All Fall that you did for Ulysses European Odyssey. But I know that before you really got into the heart of the project, you did a lot of research around the French judicial system, the migrant experience, and how those connected or didn't connect, as the case may be. Could you tell us a little bit about that research and what you discovered through it?
So we were lucky enough, over our time, we've kind of made several contacts with lawyers who work with asylum seekers and various other sort of NGOs and things. And we had a good contact with a group called ComEd, who organise access to healthcare for asylum seekers and migrants. And so we spent a long time with them just talking, listening, reading around. And so the big thing that struck us as artists who work a lot with stories, I guess, is this, the idea of the récit d'asile, which is the kind of story of your asylum. And in the French judicial system, this is a document that you're required to submit, I think it's 20 days after your arrival in France, and it will be the basis for your defence of your not being deported. And so this document, it's kind of, tell us your story, no pressure, your life may depend on it, you're possibly, almost certainly not doing it in your first language. You may have to tell that story through a translator, so with all the things that happen when you translate away from, you know, an original version. And, you know, some people are better at telling stories than others. So there's this whole, and you will have to defend yourself in front of judges in the end at some point on the basis of this story. You can add other things, but the récit d'asile is really the core. And so that kind of that, you know, imagine anyone being put in that situation where it's like, yeah, what's, you've got a sheet of A4 to give me the story of your life, make it snappy, make it emotional, make it powerful. And we were kind of fascinated and kind of horrified by the weight that is put in on this personal account and this, you know, how you tell your story. And so from there, we wanted to build, you know, in terms of how stories get told. And then also these things, when we retell stories, they change over time. And the element of performance that's involved in, say, appearing in front of judges or, you know, all storytelling, you know, whether it's between friends or now or in the pub or in front of in a court, there's all performance. So we really felt there was a lot to hold on to that we could use to kind of shine a light on the migrant and the asylum seeker experience. And so yeah, that's kind of where we went with that. I suppose that's, yeah, the research and then leading into what the project turned out to be.
And how did that lead through into the shape of the public event that you then created?
Okay, so when it came to making the public event, we knew that one of the things that we really wanted it to explore and sort of pick apart was this idea of us and them, because that's the dichotomy that so often characterizes discussions about the migrant, refugee, exile experience. And we were very struck while we were working on the project. The Ukraine war began, and there were all kinds of bits of information going around in the news in France. And one of them was, for example, that Ukrainian refugees, if they were on trains in France, were to be given free passage by conductors, train conductors, which is something that has never been offered to Syrians or Ghanaians or Palestinians. And then we were thinking back, because during the previous invasion of the Ukraine in 2014, we'd been working on an artist residency in Eastern Slovakia. And at that point, there was not at all the sort of outpouring of support from the rest of Europe for Ukraine. So something had happened in the intervening years where Ukrainians had gone from being them to being us. And that's something very interesting. So for us, there's this idea that you've got to keep pushing the us outwards until we reach the point where essentially everyone realizes that, for example, the people drowning in the Mediterranean are not them, they're us. So with those kind of feelings in mind, we wanted to make a performance where the rules about who was a spectator and who was an actor, what we were supposed to be looking at and what we were part of, who was the them and who was the us, was all blurred. So what we ultimately made, we worked with a large number of non-professional actors as well as professional actors and choreographers. And a group of students from the local art school to develop an immersive performance. So what happened when you arrived at the performance was, you came in into the outdoor space of an arts centre, and we'll talk a bit more about that at some point, and you were given a number, like a cloakroom ticket, like a raffle ticket, and they all had different little numbers on them. And everyone sort of milled around, and then at a certain point, one of us came out and designated a sort of performance space and cleared people out of an area, and then started calling numbers out. And so everyone was looking at their tickets and wondering if they were going to be called. The numbers were in fact prearranged. And so we drew people out of the crowd and got them to lie down on the ground on a piece of fabric that we'd prepared for them.
And I think the thing with the calling numbers, there was a kind of, it's that apprehension of, like, you know, we wanted to create a little bit of anxiety. There's a thing with participation, whether you want to participate or not, and kind of, you don't want to be forcing participation, and it could be very uncomfortable for people. But just to get that tension of, even if you're like, oh no, okay, I see what's going on, there's always this little doubt of, god, what if they pick me? So yeah, it was just creating kind of, again, uncertainty and, this kind of environment of everyone being potential actors, I guess, or potentially drawn in, which was kind of important thematically and also in the emotion of the, you know, what people experience. So, sorry, anyway, Gethin was saying.
And so then we had a group of about a dozen people lying down on the ground on these sheets of fabric. And then there's sort of a thing of, okay, so if that's the performance, then you're just watching them. They're not moving. But while that was happening, then all our other participants, all the other people that we've worked with the choreographer, and all those people, they came from language classes that take place in Marseille for recently arrived migrants who don't speak French. So we had a very mixed group of people there. And what they did was they started putting in place small movements, not quite dance, but choreographed movements that sort of rippled through the crowd and got bigger and moved more and more. So once again, you've got the crowd that's watching something happen, but actually what's happening is happening in and among them. So again, this us and them, what's being watched and what's being acted, having a sort of blurred boundary. What was actually happening with the fabric that was spread out on the ground that the people were lying on is that it was cyanotype treated fabric. So cyanotype is a very old form of photography that always results in blue and white images. It's where we get the word blueprint from. And what the people lying on the fabric were doing was that they were making life-size photograms of their own bodies on the fabric.
So which will be dark blue images with their body will be white where the shadow is, but kind of distorted by the shadows, and then with this really powerful blue background. But none of that, you can't see any of that whilst you're, you know, I mean, there was this kind of idea, you're watching paint dry. There's just the performances, people lying on the ground, and then you're like, ah, and then that movement. I know the performances around you. And I think there's one thing we did sort of workshops in theatre in Valence, in sort of up in the middle of France. And at the end of those workshops, there was a thing where there was kind of reading of excerpts of, you know, these Plessis d'Asile and these very powerful stories. And we had people in the audience. And I had this moment where, you know, we protect ourselves from the horrors of these stories. The making, othering or making those people then, you know, we all do it. It's to protect ourselves. It's so that we can go on with our lives, so that we can, because what's happening is horrific. And so it's a defense mechanism we all have. It's kind of a shield we put up. And so in that testing, we've done this thing where at a certain point after some of these, you know, kind of recollections of the experience that were very, you know, powerful and moving, and everyone's just there keeping it together, I would just touch someone on the shoulder, you know, imagine the person sitting in front in the theater, and there's kind of an electric moment of when you break, because we build a shield around us, and when you break that just with a bit of human contact, it all goes, and you just feel the need to cry or to say something or whatever. And so we wanted to kind of reconnect or you know, tap into that experience, that need, how we isolate ourselves, but actually we want to be in connection. It's part of human nature to we're not isolated animals, we're group animals, and we need other people. But we have this whole culture and society that's atomizing and pushing us into the smaller and smaller groups, because that's what you need. And actually, no, what you need is connection. And so with a lot of our work, it's creating a space of connection where you can be vulnerable and you can experience emotions and you can be open to these stories and the experience of those other people who are really a lot more like you than unlike you, you know, if you look on the scheme of things. So that was kind of what was going on within that performance, is these little movements and, you know, kind of slight contacts and uncontacts. You're not looking at a stage where stuff is happening far away.
The next, when we knew that the time that the cyanotype fabric had been exposed for long enough for it to create an image, at that point, all the people who were lying on the fabric got up and bundled the fabric in close to them, sort of protecting it from the light. And the whole performance moved into the interior of the arts center, where there's a huge, there's a huge pit that we filled up to waist depth with water. It's about 2.5 meters deep. It's like a big concrete cube.
The arts center is a former industrial site. So, yeah. And it's very it's still quite raw. So, yeah, you're in this kind of, and you have this again in the porosity, you have a movement from the outside to the inside, and then they go down into this, yeah, this kind of hole in the ground where there's the water.
And at that point, they rinsed out the cyanotype fabric, and it's only at that point that the blue and white image becomes visible.
So up until then, the audience has no idea what's going on other than, you know, there's no visible image. And even then, the water just turns a strange colour. But it's actually then the art students attend. Young people come out of the pit. They climb up a ladder and they go up into higher space in the art center. And they hang down. There's a kind of the reveal moment where you see these kind of floating bodies, forms, white on blue, up in the sky. During the moment of the rinsing, the kind of the elder students from the language school, mostly women, I think. And there's this thing of like, who's left behind? They were performing a very kind of a simple choreography, face to the crowd.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's the reveal, you know, kind of this moment of end applause. And then there was a very powerful moment where all the our kind of co-creators, participants, all stood underneath the cyanotypes and applauded back to the crowd. And there was this kind of echoing backwards and forwards. And you have this thing of loads of these people are kind of invisible, either, you know, society wants them to be invisible or they need to be invisible because their situation is difficult and they'd sooner not be seen. And here you have this a very kind of powerful, beautiful kind of exchange and being seen in a positive light, in a creative light, and telling the story, in a, you know, kind of validating the story and their presence.
I did, though, just want to reference back what you talked about, because I had, for example, I'd never heard of cyanotypes until you told us that this was your plan within the project. And one of the things I loved about it was that, referencing back, you were talking about, you know, for the migrant, for the asylum seeker, there's like a constant uncertainty in their lives, and it's potentially very ephemeral. What was beautiful about cyanotypes, as I remember you saying, is that that they fade over time, and then you have to put them back in water, and when you do that, you know, it's almost like miraculously they reappear, and that just seemed to tap in as well to the narrative that you were exploring. And as you say, at the event, that wonderful sort of applause back and forward, the sense also of the performers and the audience mingling, was very moving, and it was perfect in the context of what you were seeking to achieve. I also just wanted to pick up, though, on the Arts Centre's venue, because the one proviso we had made to the various city partners was that your event had to take place in a public space, because in Ulysses, quite a number of the episodes take place in like a school, hospital, library, etc. So we wanted public space to be at the heart of the public events. And I thought you made it was such an imaginative and relevant choice. And I wanted to just say a little bit about how that relationship was fostered.
The art centre that we worked with is called Atelier Jeanne Barret. And it's a relatively new art centre in Marseille. And it's in an area that is undergoing enormous change and upheaval at the moment. It's an area that was previously kind of industrial sites and sort of first generation immigrant arrival housing, and is now being changed into something that is fancy new apartment buildings and first generation immigrant arrival housing. And so this art centre is implanted in that area, and it's a lovely art centre to work with, because they have a real belief that they should have an interaction with and a responsibility towards their local community. So, for example, when we did the performance there, we were able to do it on a day when once a month they open their doors so that people from the local community can come in and hold a shared meal at that art centre. So you have families who just live nearby and who use it as a space communally on that day. And we were able to, by choosing that day to hold our performance, to bring an audience that wouldn't necessarily have been drawn to an event like ours into that, and again, create a heterogeneous audience for the event that we were putting on.
And then, I think that's really important. you get, we kind of, there's this layering, or the, or hopefully not layering, but mixing of the audience, so that you have the kind of NGO, you know, remit, or the people who are involved in that, and then you have people who are more from a, say, a visual arts background, and then you have people from a dance background, and then you have, yeah, the kind of local inhabitants who, you know, chance upon it, and they're all there experiencing it together, and kind of drawn into it, because, yeah, there's this whole thing of, it's not just something that's happening externally to you, it's happening around you, and you've just bumped up against it, and oh, you're making the movement that that person's making, and you've become part of the whole, you know, the shared experience. And then after it finishes, we have the communal meal with a barbecue, and everyone eats together, and they talk, and they can, and so, and there's a chance to talk again to you know, the people who've been part of the performance. If you have questions, you know, that there is in the thing of porosity, it's super porous. There is all this, you know, the possibilities to exchange during and afterwards, and also in a kind of environment where it can be hard to wander up to someone and say, oh, how did you feel about such and such? But if you're queuing for the barbecue, or share, you know, sharing a drink or whatever, it becomes much easier to have those sort of interactions. And that was really important coming out of the space, but also in how we structured the event, that it kind of gave this possibility. Again, it's like there is the performance, but everything that's going on around the performance is part of the artwork, you know, before and after, the mixing and the talking and the you know, the collective experience is the day rather than the duration of the performance.
And possibly even more than the day, that it, maybe it's even also the workshops that we did leading up to it with the groups, where we had, again, a mixed group of people from the language classes and people from the art school, and that we had the possibility to all be in rehearsals together and to sit and eat together at lunchtime, and that is also part of it.
Mm. So yourselves and Marseille, it's part of 18 cities and creative partners coming together. This project was shaped through Zoom because of COVID, and we had all collectively done quite a lot of work before we actually had the opportunity to meet for the first time in person, which was last October 2022 in Trieste. I just wanted to get your sort of take on that first meeting, because I think it's fair to say none of us quite knew what to expect. You meet people on Zoom, it's not the same as meeting them in person, and we came together and we talked over 2 days. So what was your first impressions of that experience?
First of all, it was kind of amazing just to see people in real life, having had that much contact with them over such a long period of time, to actually meet people and be like, wow, you are so much taller than I was expecting, or to hear somebody's laugh, to, you know, all the extra bits of communication that we have, but that get filtered out when we're being sort of effective and sensible and trying to get work done in a meeting on Zoom. So it was lovely to have all of that put into place. All those missing pieces just fell into place immediately.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, so there have been a few of these kind of partner gatherings, and, you know, that thing of being effective and whatever. One of the things that strikes me, I mean, you know, it, over time, you know, it's come, you know, there's the Ulysses family and all this, and I'm super skeptical and wary of that kind of, oh, we're all a big family, and it, you know, it's kind of like, it's very sort of, you can be business speaky, I guess, but it, there really is that feeling of this huge project that we're all pulling towards the end, and kind of feeding and encouraging and supporting. And, you know, the thing of being effective, it's like, you know, when in the meetings we'll talk about really difficult, important subjects, you know, identity or migration, or, you know, fear and uncertainty, nationalism. They're big subjects, and we can do that, and you go really deep into those subjects in a way that I think personally and creatively is incredibly rich and stimulating. But also, yeah, and then you can laugh. It's not this kind of po-faced. I think it's really important that that, I mean, that maybe this is a personal belief, but I think that you should be allowed to be sweary and silly and, you know, and laugh, and that there should be joy. You're not, I don't think the world gets fixed or made any better in earnest Zoom meetings. You know, you need people and you need the rough edges and you need to, yeah, you need laughter and that kind of positiveness that will come out of, you know, being put in a situation together. So, yeah, and in that way, there is a real, I think that is quite a family feel, and also, you know, or maybe, you know, better than family, because there's, you know, it's just a very interesting structure in terms of making connections across Europe. And I think personally for us, we feel it's like, you know, you get to know all the partners really well. You know their projects, you know their concerns, you know, and there's that kind of grounding of the professional that then allows you to help or not help, or, you know, and to have empathy and compassion, I guess. So, yeah, no, it's a very interesting, powerful experience.
And I would say as well that being having an interest in sort of mixed groups, it's fantastic. Like, I remember when we were, you know, when we were coming back from Trieste, Miles saying, I've never felt so European. You know, that the thing of, do you want to say about that?
Well, you know, you're all sitting in a room and you have Marco talking about, you know, the post. There was one of the workshops was where we would talk about the histories of our city kind of through a personal story that goes into the greater history of your city. So the kind of personal becoming the more, you know, not universal, but general for your city. So describing the city like that. And so Marco has talked about the end of Salazar. And so, you know, you have this one funny personal story about, you know, a fascist dictator. And then, you know, Mate's been talking about his experience in Budapest or you know, Rasa and Vilnius. And so there you have, you know, the communist totalitarian systems. And you're in that space and all these stories are overlapping and we're all European. And there's just this feeling of Europe is an insane and beautiful folly. The notion that we can be European, that European is a thing, is, you know, as an idea, it's incredibly optimistic and kind of an empowering and very beautiful. And of course, there are dissonances but actually, that is the proof. We all come through. We all have our different, vastly different starting points, and we all end up in that space and find common ground and talk through issues and kind of, and yeah, that's Europe in a nutshell. You can travel around Europe, but here you're in a situation where all of Europe is in one room. And that is, it's just an incredibly powerful kind of telescoping of this idea of Europe, which is fascinating and kind of, I think, you know, for everyone, I think is kind of enriching in our idea of how we might work and also how we might see, you know, yeah, the notion of being European, I guess.
And it gives great hope as well that we can work as a very different, disparate, heterogeneous us.
I completely agree. I would just add also that it's very easy in the arts to feel at times you're working in isolation. One of the joys of this project, particularly when we met in person, was the realization that you're not, and that you're inspired by the work that other people are doing. And as you both say, that sense of being European, which I think had it not been for those physical gatherings, we might not have felt it so strongly. You can't pick that up in the same way on Zoom, but physically being together. And just referencing back to what you said earlier, Miles, about in your project, the importance of touch and connection. Well, it was the physical coming together of the partners as well that I think took the project to another level.
I certainly noticed that we became exponentially more effective in the Zoom meetings after meeting in person. It was like everybody suddenly had this grounding in the real existence of everybody else. And it just, it made everything just make more sense. It made us more effective. It made us work more quickly after we'd actually met in person. And I have to say, like, at the very beginning of this project, I had this feeling that, okay, that's great. This project will allow us to make the creative artwork that we want to make. And the rest of it, I wasn't as interested in. And now I'm actually really delighted that our creative artwork was made and finished right near the beginning of the project, because in fact, it frees us up mentally and emotionally to be more involved in the continuing, more collective aspects of the project. And that's been a really nice surprise.
One of my abiding memories of the whole project was at the end of Trieste when Agathon came up to me and said, there's nobody amongst us all that I would mind being stuck in a lift with. I thought that's a perfect description, actually, because there was nobody that was in any way negative as we all worked and talked together. It was such a positive feeling. So I thought you captured it well in that sentence.
I think also there's a thing when lots of people in the arts are brought together, there's often a slight element of competition because of the situation. It will often be because you're all applying for the same pot of funding, or you're all at something where you know like certain people will be noticed, etc. And what we have within this project, part of the reason it's able to be so mutually supportive is because everybody has already been financially supported by the project. We all know that we're part of this and we are all funded together, and that is all out of the way and decided. And it really does free you up to be much more available in many ways to the other partners.
I noticed on your website that just below your names, you've got the phrase, try to make things better. I wonder if you'd maybe say a little bit about that, but also leading into it, then why did you want to be involved in this project?
Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, so I think the try to make things better is, you know, yeah, I guess it's, because it says Gethin and Miles try to make things better. So it's kind of, yeah, but it's the idea of an art. So it's just trying not to be shit. Can I say that? But, you know.
You have.
Or we can go back. So it's trying to do things as well as you can, trying to make something, you know, in the making. You're in this kind of pursuit of perfection, which will never be fulfilled, but you try and do it better and better. I guess it's that, you know,
each time
failing again and failing better as well. But so that's, yeah, there's a notion of trying to make work that's better. But of course, it's like there's also this thing of, you know, yeah, making it better, making the human experience, which can be very difficult. And as we've said, kind of very isolating. Trying to make, you know, just being human now, a better, happier, more joyous collective experience. I don't know, Gethin, if you think there's anything else to...
No, I agree. Everything he said. So then in terms of the project, we were first contacted about the project through a friend of ours who's a journalist, an Irish journalist who's based in Marseille. And I think the first time we spoke to you guys about the project, we were actually being enlisted sort of to point you to people that you could potentially work with in Marseille. And we had a great long and indiscreet conversation with you about, you know, oh, they're brilliant to work with, and oh, they're great, but, you know, they always do things at the last minute, and told you about all these other people you could work with. And then we went away. But there was
quite a long time of backwards and forwards. Yeah. And, oh, you could go to them. And it was this kind of thing of you're pushing people away. And we were like...
Then we realized as well more and more what you wanted from the project, it was like, we're actually already working on something that would be perfect for this, because we were already in the research phase for the project about the Récit d'Asile at that time.
That kind of, you know, Hollywood moment where you go, the person that you're looking for is me, and, you know, and then, you know, you ride off into the sunset.
Yeah.
But I think the more we talked and kind of got to know your needs for, or, you know, kind of what you hopes, I guess, for the project. Yeah, we don't really, it's not interesting to us to do a kind of historical pastiche of, you know, Joyce and you know, reenactment. And it's this idea that I think underlies it, that, you know, it's a radical reimagining of a radical novel. You don't, you know, you should, we need to do something that is contemporary, because Ulysses kind of, you know, blew the world up in its way. And it's much more interesting to make pieces of work which are inspired by, but are about now. And so when that became clear, we were like, and with loads of other stuff as well, you know, it was like, yeah, that, can we do that? And then it, you know, and it moved on, and it's, you know, it's become this, yeah, you know, this, you then enter into this whole, the odyssey of it over 2 years. And it's been, yeah, very, you know, interesting, creatively rich and humanly rich experience.
Yeah, it's been one of the most nourishing projects that we have been involved with, for us and our practice.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine us all not working together now. Yeah, sadly that will happen.
Never.
Come next year. But yes, it has been joyous. It has been joyous, and it's been, certainly I kind of feel from our perspective, it's been a privilege to be involved in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, same. Totally.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Ulysses European Odyssey. For more information on the project, please go to our website, ulysseseurope.eu.